Madeleine disappeared from apartment 5A here at the Ocean Club in Praia da Luz. The Portuguese inquiry was closed in 2008, but the British police have now uncovered more than 20 new suspects, including British tourists, people who worked here, and known paedophiles who were in the Algarve at the time of Madeleine's disappearance.
I would say it's almost impossible to believe it wasn't searched, because I saw the search was so thorough, and this is very close to the apartment. So yes, it had to have been searched. It would have been searched visually at that stage. Remember that we were looking for a child that had wandered away. We weren't looking for an abduction, we weren't looking for a murder, we weren't looking for an accident. That came up a couple of days later when nobody could find any trace of the child at all, and started to think out of the immediate box and think, well, perhaps this could happen in Praia da Luz. But things like this don't happen in Portugal. And it remains to see now what they're going to do here.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, former head of the Homicide Prevention Unit at New Scotland Yard, criminal behavioral analyst and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. And off we go again, talking about this disappearance of Madeleine McCann. One thing we haven't talked about is the role of the media in this case. I just found them absolutely outrageous in the salacious nature of their headlines. Things like trying to say that Jerry was not really Madeleine's father after the DNA was collected. Just atrocious. It just reminded me so much of after Meredith Kircher's
murder. Yes, that's what I was going to say.
How they just invented things about Amanda Knox. And I just think that they should just be called out as absolutely disgusting and not at all helpful, and just trying to find things that weren't there, invent things, and just... Even the journalists that were shown in the document, in the Netflix documentary, they seem totally proud about it. They have no shame about the things that they just made up.
And that's exactly what happened in the Meredith Kircher case, where the media, obviously, and in the documentary, this media guy, and yes, I'm using air quotes because I don't think he was a legitimate media guy.
You're talking about Nick Pizzi?
Yes, I am. And
yeah, Daily Mail, Nick Pizzi, who's still a reporter.
Yeah, and he was proud of the fact that he was able to worm his way in to get information from the cops. And no matter what, he said, well, if I took the time to vet the information and confirm it, then it wouldn't be a scoop anymore. So, of course, I just printed it, even though it was completely unsubstantiated, completely ridiculous, and obviously biased. That's not the job of the media. The media is supposed to report credible evidence, credible stories, stories that have been confirmed, stories that come from reliable sources, and not something that is meant to clearly sway the public one way or the other. And I think that happened in this case as well. But it happened in such a random order. It happened in such a ridiculous way. I don't think it's bad personally to have media get involved in child abduction cases. I think they're a necessary component. I think they could be incredibly helpful in helping resolve child abduction cases by getting involved and getting the word out right away. It's the policy behind Amber Alerts. Get the word out to people immediately that this child is missing and endangered. And the media can help with that. But when they start doing salacious things like you mentioned, Lisa, that doesn't help with the investigation. In fact, it can close down avenues of real investigation. It can prevent law enforcement from actually finding out what happened.
Firstly, just to talk about Nick Pizzi, because I think the documentary you're referring to is the Netflix one, right? Mm-hmm. Called the Amanda Knox documentary. And yes, he hangs himself, doesn't he? Right at the end when he basically says, well, why would I fact check? I mean, you know, I wouldn't have been able to print it, the story. And he was in cahoots with Mignini.
Yes.
The prosecutor, he was being fed all sorts of information that he didn't corroborate, and he went on to her one of her profiles. It wasn't on LinkedIn. It was on some MySpace, I think. Yeah. Yes. And he was the one that dubbed her and, you know, inverted commas, Foxy Noxy, and sent everyone down that route that this was some kind of ritualistic killing, when, of course, there was zero evidence to show that. Yeah. He's still, you know, a reporter. I believe he was reporting on Rudy Guaidó being out and about in Italy. And that was the man who was found to be responsible for raping and killing Meredith Kircher.
Right. Actually convicted, sentenced, jailed, and now released. I mean, he was in jail almost less time than Amanda Knox was. It's ridiculous. And he's actually the convicted murderer. And to celebrity that they've foisted on him, he's the aggrieved party. It just makes me sick.
Yeah. And then talking about the, you know, the Madeleine McCann, just the British media perspective, I think actually originally the media were very sympathetic. Kate and Jerry, don't forget, actually called the media themselves. They called a journalist from the Daily Mail, and I think we saw him on the documentary. So they were calling people and getting them to come to Prayer Deluge. Mm-hmm. And I think originally there was this very sympathetic sense and people wanting to help them. But I think actually over time, the media started to become less sympathetic to Jerry and Kate. And people felt that they were covering things up and hiding things. And maybe they weren't presenting themselves as concerned and worried parents. I know certainly Kate McCann got a very hard time, and I'm just sort of repeating back some of the things over the years, because people felt she wasn't maternal enough, or she wasn't upset enough, or she wasn't behaving in a way that a mother would behave, and that she was just detached and she had no emotion. And Jerry was the same. He had no emotion, and they seemed to not be behaving like parents who have had their daughter abducted. Yeah. And I think that's where sympathy dropped off. And I know they've had lots of trolling issues. They've had death threats, all sorts of things. I think
that's all wrong. I mean, that's absolutely criminal. But on the other hand, Laura, what we did see from them was they mentioned their daughter's name all the time. They talk as if she's still alive. They continue to hold out hope that she will be found. Whereas in a number of notorious cases where parents or parent or guardian was involved in the death of a child and then made a false allegation, a lot of times what happens is you see them distance themselves from the child, not mention the name, and not show any connection at all to the child. And in fact, before anybody knows anything about what happened to the child, talk about the child in the past tense. And so those things we didn't see with the McCanns. However, I think as you've pointed out in the past, there's also the fact that they were not interviewed separately. They were always together making these statements. And some people have said those statements seem to be sort of scripted or rehearsed. I don't agree. I think I see those statements as being the result of parents who are frantic, who are frustrated that they can't get the police to do some of the things that they should have done, including interview the parents and including doing full court press immediately on the night that she was reported missing, as opposed to waiting till the next day and so forth. So my opinion is that I thought their statements were misinterpreted by the press, and that, as Lisa said, I don't think it was fair at all. I mean, you can't put parents in a pigeonhole box. I do think that they were very polished people. And so I think they were concerned about their image and what was out there. But that does not make them bad parents. It does not make them the killers of Maddie.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm certainly not an expert in behavior, but if you think about the broad strokes of behavior as being part action and part affect, I am an expert in affect, because that's what I do every day, is watch affect of actors who may be feeling one way on the inside and showing something else on the outside. And watching the McCanns, you know, I certainly felt their fatigue and grief and worry, and I didn't see what other people have mentioned about their coldness and Kate not being maternal, because as you both have said, behavior is so complicated, and people respond in different ways depending on their culture and their background. And so I don't get it. I don't get the low sympathy for them as far as their affect goes.
Well, I'm going to disagree with both of you because I actually do take into account the fact that they've been coached from very early on. And I don't think I've seen that with any other family. But bearing in mind that someone from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office from the Media Monitoring Unit flew out there within days, and the first press conference they gave to me was polished. I wouldn't expect to be seeing something so scripted and rehearsed from a family who has no law enforcement background, or, you know, they're right in the eye of the storm of their daughter going missing. And they seem to literally tick every box off as if they have been rehearsed so well. And that's a problem for me. It's a problem that you've got a live ongoing investigation and they have been schooled by some of the top people in media right from the start.
But that didn't happen until 12 days in.
They flew out immediately, Jim. Five civilians from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office flew out, and one of them was a former Fleet Street journalist.
Yeah, I have down that happened on the 15th. I mean, maybe my days are wrong, but I believe they didn't come till the 12 days after the abduction. I think the first press conferences that they gave were, well, they may have been very professional, or, you know, very image conscious.
They'd written down everything. Jerry basically read from a piece of paper.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think that did happen, yes.
Yeah, and it was very articulate. And of course, I do put that against the fact that they are educated, they're articulate, they're intelligent, they're eloquent. So I'm putting that caveat on it. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it was so pre-planned and so polished, and that's what people react to, you see. And I just have to put it in the terms of normal people and how I felt when I saw it. And I'm trying to take myself back to that time.
Right.
Because even I raised an eyebrow. I've never seen a family come out looking so polished, and even the arm placement, everything seemed to have been thought through, that I didn't really see any leakage of true emotion. Mm-hmm. Now, when the media advisors went out there, and of course Clarence Mitchell, we know, took over that role, they would have been saying things like, make sure you mention her name, make sure you say her name as often as possible, you know. And of course they set up the Find Madeline Fund within 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, as a parent, if you have the means to do it, you would do it if you felt the police weren't listening or doing the right thing. So I have no criticism of that. But what I was concerned about was, one, seeing a lack of effect on Kate's face and her continual looking towards Jerry. And I'm going back to the original interviews, which I looked at many moons ago, that she would default to him all the time. Now, that could be through trauma, and we never know how we're going to react, but she did default to him to give his narrative, and they did contradict themselves multiple times about whether they searched, whether they didn't themselves. I remember going back in time, Kate apparently didn't go out searching, and statements have changed over time. But third to that was a statement that was given by, I believe it was Kate's uncle, Brian Kennedy, within 2 weeks of Madeline being missing. People were pledging money and pledging a lot of money to help them. I think it worked out to be something like, they got 4 million, but it worked out to be in the early days, £6,000 a day, £260 an hour was being pledged. And Brian Kennedy, in his interview, was asked about that Find Madeline Fund, and he said that the money would be used for legal expenditure. Now, that for me is a major red flag. So it's not one thing on its own. It's just drawing things together within that first month period, where normally you've got chaos and crisis, and you've got two parents who, you know, are asking for assistance. They're being told by the Portuguese police not to talk to the media. It's not legal in Portugal to talk to the media where there's an ongoing investigation. They go against what they're being told. Probably the media advisors are helping them with that. I don't know. But they are also, you know, coming across as very polished to the British public. And when they're used to seeing how people react, what the British public are feeling, and certainly what the media are feeling, is that they're acting unlike anything else that's been seen before. Now, that's not to say that I think people should troll them or make death threats or all these heinous things that have happened. because what I do see on both their faces is anguish and upset and loss. And no one deserves to be treated in the way that, as you've described, Lisa, has happened. And this is kind of pre-Leveson as well. We had a big public inquiry around the way media dealt with information and how they handled it. So both these cases are pre-Leveson. The media have now been brought much more to book and to account so that they are meant to report on the facts and the evidence and not give this very biased opinion. But all across those interviews of years worth of interviews, they did come across unlike any other family who have had a situation like this unfold. And from very early on, they said it was an abduction. Now, they continue to say it's an abduction. I've been on the Find Madeline webpage. Have you visited the website?
No, I have not.
I mean, it's worth having a look at. It's still up and running. It's still requesting, putting information on there and requesting information to come in. And I believe they're forwarding everything to Operation Grange. But again, it's very polished. They've had a huge amount of money and funds. $4 million is an awful lot of money, of public money, that hasn't been accounted for because it wasn't set up as a charity. But all of the interviews that you see of Jerry and Kate, they are all very polished. And that is what people are reacting to, I believe, the lack of real emotion, that everything does seem to be scripted. And even to the point Kate makes a comment of saying on one of the interviews, the truth will out eventually. Truth will out eventually is something that I've always said. The truth will out eventually. I've never heard a civilian, I've never heard a mother or a father say something like that. And I just
maybe she listens to you. Maybe she's heard you say that.
Who knows? But all these things, they're all little things, but they just give an indication that they are schooled and they have been schooled. And therefore, we have to bear that in mind
right,
with what we're seeing and hearing.
Thirteen days after Madeline's disappearance, Robert Murat was named as a suspect. He was later completely cleared, but has told 5 News he still feels the case is hanging over him.
I've tried to move on and my family's tried to move on, but it's always something that I'm linked to. Whenever there's anything that's new, my name gets mentioned in it. So I'd like to see it resolved.
What would it mean to you if this case could be solved?
Oh, everything. I think if it could be solved, I think that's that, everything, yeah.
It would mean you can finally move on?
Yeah.
I think we've already discussed the fact that none of us believe that there was some intentional murder of Madeline McCann by her parents or family members. So what that leaves us with is Madeline's parents definitely suffered the loss of their daughter. She has not been in their life for 12 years. Although there is hope that she could still be alive somewhere, that possibility and that probability diminishes with time. And it's unfortunate. But so they have suffered the loss. She has been missing for these 12 years. So it's, you would think either way, you would see the ramifications of loss on this family, whether it was an accidental death or whether she was taken from somebody by somebody else. What I don't understand is how the interpretation of the events has basically somehow justified people in attacking them and threatening them and wishing them harm. They somehow feel that because Madeline is missing and they don't know what it is that happened to her, that it's okay to do things that are very, you know, that are illegal. It's illegal to threaten somebody's life. It's illegal. But people feel justified in doing it. But in terms of what happened in the media coverage and so forth, I believe that were I in their shoes, I would have called the media right away because I know how to interact with the media, how through my experience in the behavioral analysis unit, how the media can be very helpful in the first hours of these kinds of investigations. But what also has to happen at that same time is the investigation has to proceed immediately into the closest circle around that child, and that is the family. And in unless and until you rule out the family, then what you do is you risk losing evidence and losing viable leads. Until you determine what the window of opportunity is, who was the last to see this person alive, who might have had access to the person, all these really important details, until you get that information, you can't really launch a proper investigation. So that, unfortunately, didn't happen immediately. There were delays that really should not have happened. But again, the way the law is set up in Portugal, they don't treat a missing person as a crime, even if it is a small child. And that's really unfortunate.
Well, we have to remember that the Portuguese police also closed the investigation in 2008. So run really for just under a year. And the DNA, which we're going to get to, the forensics report that came back from the Forensic Science Service in the UK, who I used to work with when I was at New Scotland Yard, that report was submitted back to the Portuguese police and they misinterpreted what was said within it. But the repercussions of what was said and what was overstated meant that Gonzalo Amaral, the lead detective in the case, he was forced to resign. And so that happened, I believe it was in the October. And he then went on to write the book and the documentary. So the book was called The Truth of the Lie, and the documentary had the same title. And in it, I just want to say one thing that was said in the documentary right at the start. He said, in the next 50 minutes, I will prove that the child was not abducted and died in the holiday apartment in Praia da Luz. He made a very clear claim that Madeline was already dead, and that he would prove via evidence that she had been abducted. Now, of course, this goes against exactly what the McCanns were saying. They said right from the start she had been abducted. So you've got their very strong narrative being pushed out in the media that it's an abduction, and that's what's on the Find Madeline website, that it's an abduction. No doubt about that.
But they couldn't say anything else, though, could they? If they were saying anything else, it would be to admit that they were somehow involved.
Well, Jim Gamble, as of I think it was yesterday, so there's another piece in the media that Jim Gamble came out with and said that he believes that she took herself off, that she wandered out of the apartment and then came to harm some way, you know, somehow or another. And the McCanns have hit back at him now and said that they believe that that's a ridiculous scenario to be trotted out in the media. And that
what is he basing that on?
Well, he said that it's something that has to be considered and that she could well have just taken herself off and then come to harm. I mean, it's the same thing of what, you know, the McCanns are basing their theory on, that she was abducted. There's no evidence to support that she was abducted. There's no evidence to support she wandered off. You know, if you take the wandered off scenario, Cuddle Cat was still left on her bed. Now, little children tend to take their comforter or take pillows with them, Jim, or other things when they wake up and they wander off or want to find mummy and daddy. So for me, I don't believe that she did wander off. But Jim Gamble, there's a piece in the Daily Star saying that he favours that theory and the McCanns favour the abduction theory. Amaral basically is very clear in his book, and that's what ended up in a civil case, the McCanns suing him on a human rights Article 3 issue. And that's what it came down to in the civil case.
Well, to me, what Jim Gamble is saying is only half the story. I mean, came to harm. If she wandered off and came to harm, that harm, in my opinion, must have been abduction, because otherwise her body would have been found or she would have been found alive. There has to have been a third party involved in that for that to actually result in her disappearing completely. There is no indication anywhere that she got hit by a car, fell down a cliff, whatever it is. There's nothing. There's no evidence that has ever been found. And I think had she been just wandered off, I think we've discussed this before, had she just wandered off on her own, which is possible at her age, there would have been evidence of where she went and where she ended up.
Yeah, how did she get out of the gate? you know, it was gated, right?
Yeah, but but it's certainly unlocked, but
so their apartment was right on the corner, 5A. So no, it wasn't gated. We must remember the door was open. The McCanns said that they left the door open.
Door, right?
Yeah, and so she could have gotten out. And I mean, I guess, Jim, it depends whether you believe the searches were conducted thoroughly within that year that the Portuguese were searching. Because I don't have any confidence in those searches, I have to say, from the evidence and from what police and others who worked on the investigation have said, that the ground was never cleared from under their feet. They never really did thorough searches in the way that if it were treated as a missing child right from the start, rather than a non-criminal matter, which is what they saw it as, that those first 24 hours were missed golden hours of opportunity.
Right. Yeah, they should have searched first. Thing they should have done is searched every child-sized container in that apartment, in that building, in all of the top of seven's apartments, in the garages, you know, and that search should have gone out exponentially. That wasn't done. At the same time, they should have been interviewing all those people separately and comparing notes on what these people said. That is the critical first hour of the investigation. When that wasn't done, every hour that you delay it increases the chance exponentially that you will never solve this case. So it's unfortunate, but I do believe that if the searches were done properly and nothing has ever been found, her clothing, anything belonging to her, any indication that there was a body in a particular place outside, all those things, we just never got any evidence of that. So I'm just really questioning where Jim Gamble comes up with this issue. I don't think, although you say that there's no evidence of abduction, if you're a parent and you know your child, you may know that she's afraid to wander off. The night before, a neighbor said that they heard, I think it was the night before, Madeline cry out for her daddy for a long period of time. And that may be how she responds, and the parents may know this, that, and they may maybe wakes up in the middle of the night and does this and calls out for her daddy or her mommy, and they know this, that she doesn't get up and wander or whatever. So they can have a level of confidence that we can't have from the outside in her behavior. But if they do know that she was left in that bed, and if they do know that she's no longer there, I do believe that is a reasonable conclusion that they could draw that she was taken by somebody, especially if they know the window was closed and now the window is open and the shutter is open. And I just while we're on that point, I just want to repeat that when in the podcast, the quote expert who went in and said it would be impossible or almost impossible for somebody to have taken Madeline out that window because the shutter would have completely continuously fallen down. I think that's absurd, because if the shutter is not open and it is a metal shutter, it's like a storm shutter. It's one that will prevent high winds from blowing the window, breaking the window, whatever. It's not just a security shutter. And if when Kate saw the window open, she also saw that the shutter was closed, I would have assumed that she would have said something like that. But she said that the wind blew the curtain open. So to me, that means the shutter was also open so that the wind could come through. If the shutter doesn't stop the wind, well, we've seen the shutter. We know what it's made of. We know that it doesn't have big holes that the wind can come through. So if the wind did come through the curtain like that, the shutter must have been open. So there is a mechanism which would had to have been part of the design of that shutter that it could be opened so that the window could be opened, sun could come in, air could come in. So there's just flaws in how Mark Sarnakernacker,
that's good,
of the Maddie podcast. It's very difficult for me to pronounce his name. I'm sorry, Mark. I don't mean to, you know, take it lightly, but it's just a very difficult name to pronounce, but a very unique name too. And that's a great thing. But, you know, he does also talk about testing the hair of the surviving twins months later, and the fact that that hair did not show any indication that the children had been drugged on that night. Well, the problem with what he states is that he clearly doesn't understand the science and technology behind it. So if somebody has drugs in their system, not all drugs, but some drugs will actually show up in the hair follicles that are in their head at the time that the drug is in their system. And we all know that hair generally grows, unless you're me. And the part of the hair that actually contains that drug evidence actually grows away from the scalp. And so if you're a boy and you get your hair cut periodically, shortly, a short period of time after you've had that drug in your system, it could be cut off and then it wouldn't be in your hair anymore. So generally hair grows about a half an inch a month, but it can be radically different with children. It can grow a lot faster. And so what is determinative about whether or not that drug would be still evidenced in their hair is how long the hair is and how long it's been in their head. For example, if somebody had a buzz cut or shaved their head the next day, it would be gone the next day and it wouldn't still be there. If the hair grew 4, 5, 6 inches over the next 6 months and it was cut down to 3 inches or 2 inches, then half of that hair that had been containing that evidence is now gone. So it's just the technology needs to be explained correctly. And so to me, the fact that 6 months later, these children did not have any hair evidence that they were on drugs at the time, that there was any drugs in their system at the time, does not definitively say that they weren't actually medicated at the time. So it's just an unfortunate problem that they were tested so much later. If they had taken hair samples the next day or the next week, it would have been fine. But 4 to 6 months later, I'm sorry, you run a real risk that the hair has been trimmed and the part of the hair that was in the head at the time that did contain the evidence has been cut off.
Portuguese people will never forget the impact they've had in the first moment that the Portuguese police admitted the possibility of McCann's being involved on Madeline's disappearance. This was a very strong turning point. And I don't know if it will be possible to the Portuguese people just forget it.
And that's one of the key problems with the whole of this case, you know, of everything being done too late in the day. But just to go back on to 2 points, Jim, that you mentioned. So one, Kate saying about the window being open, the shutters being up. Of course, no one else saw that. That was her account, but it wasn't corroborated by anybody else. And I mean that in the sense that when the PJ turned up, the window had been shut. The shutters have been pulled down, and we've got to remember that the twins were still sleeping in there. So no one else saw that. We know that there was a partial palm print of Kate's, which is from opening the window, but of course that could have been from any time. That's not to say it's relevant to that night. We can't age those things. But the twins were left in the room, the very room that Kate and Jerry say that Maddie was abducted from, and I still bump on that, of leaving children in a room when home intrusions and invasions are very intrusive, very upsetting. Even if you have your house burgled, you know, I know people who haven't wanted to go back into their home after burglary because you feel like someone's been violated everything.
Right.
So why leaving the twins in there? And we did discuss that in the last episode, but that's a major red flag for me, and the fact that they are sleeping through everything. And the police actually comment on that at the time. And we still have to remember with the timeline, no one saw Madeline after 5:30 p.m. So after she was picked up from the nursery by Kat, who I think worked there, or from the, you know, the Ocean Club, Madeline wasn't seen thereafter, not by anybody else. Even when the checks were allegedly being done, there was no sighting of Madeline. So the timeline I still have no confidence in, for all the reasons that we've previously discussed. And Jim Gamble, just to put him back in context, he was asked by Alan Johnson, the then Home Secretary, because Alan Johnson thought that Jim was a stand-up guy. He asked and tasked him specifically to look at and review what had been done around the disappearance of Madeleine McCann. And in his report, this is the secret report that's referred to by Martin Brunt, the Sky News investigator, in his one-hour special on Madeleine McCann. Jim Gamble talks about a lack of clarity and communication in the investigation and this distinct lack of trust. And so he probably is one of the few people who had eyes on the case from the very, not from the very start, but from an early stage of knowing various, you know, aspects of the investigation, but also of having involvement thereafter with Kate and Jerry McCann, who he originally said he felt a distrust of Jerry McCann, felt that Jerry may well have been involved, even to the point that he said to Jerry, if he was going to write this blog trying to appeal to whoever took Madeleine, he made a point of saying, you can always give yourself up. No matter how terrible things are, there would be, you know, sympathy and empathy. People make mistakes all the time. And if this is a mistake, and he was appealing really to Jerry, and that was Jim's first instinct. And I always say, trust your first instinct and impression, because that's the one that's normally right. But having said that, Jim Gamble then later says that he believes that she was abducted, and now he's leaning much more to the fact that she may have walked off. But to answer your question, I don't know exactly what he has based that on. It wasn't clear within the article. Perhaps he could come on Real Crime Profile and let us know. So Jim Gamble, if you're listening, we'd love to talk to you and hear a little bit more about why you believe that to be the case.
I would love that. That would be fascinating.
Yeah, that would be really interesting. You know, as you know, I mean, Jim is a very, very bright guy, and he may have information, and it may also be his gut telling him basically what he thinks happened. And I do want to, before we conclude our analysis, go through the major theories and talk amongst ourselves about what we think might have happened. But I think we also, before we get there, we should talk about some other things, like the cadaver dog and the blood dog that were brought in to do searches at the apartment, around the complex, out in the field, and around the vehicle that the McCanns rented a couple of weeks later.
Yeah, and just, we left off in our last episode about the civil case, and I just want to make mention of the fact that it was a human rights argument that Jerry and Kate brought. Because of the Truth of the Lie book and the documentary that where Amaral said that he believed that it was an accident that Madeleine had died in the apartment, and that it was a false abduction claim by the parents. Well, those who don't know about that case, what basically happened was the McCanns won. They won the libel case, and they won it on an Article 3 point that no one will suffer, among others, attacks upon one's honour and reputation, stipulating that against such attacks, anyone is entitled to the protection of the law. And so a judge ruled in their favour, and Amaral basically appealed that decision. And having been ordered to pay the money, and he wins on the appeal. And then it goes to a number of judges in the Supreme Court, and they then rule in favor of Amaral. So it flip-flops again.
Right.
They find in favor of him, in favor of Article 16, that everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media. So he wins, and that's where that statement from the judges in 2016 came from, that they said just because the police investigation was closed, that doesn't mean to say that the McCanns were cleared of a crime, and insufficiency of evidence doesn't equate to innocence. So that's an important statement that they make. Because, of course, there's still the point that one Jerry makes in this particular civil case, that he took exception to Amaral saying that Madeline was dead. But they knew in the closing report the officers had written that there's a high probability that she probably is dead, given the statistical information that's known, and there's been no sign of life. So we know that we haven't found her, but equally on the other side, there's no sign of a body, but there's no sign that she's alive. And so they're working on the probability of what normally happens in these cases, but Jerry takes exception to that. So I think the civil case is an important thread here. And the fact that Amaral decided to write the book and the documentary, given it works in stark contrast to the fact when he was in the police, he wasn't allowed to talk to the media. And then he, you know, wrote this book, which I believe has been very popular, and the documentary. I don't know if you've seen, either of you have seen the documentary.
They just reported on it in the other documentary and right. in the podcast about it. It seemed very sensational, but
I mean, freedom of expression won out in that case. And I guess that's an important part, because I think some people still think that Kate and Jerry won that libel case, which is not the case. Right. So we've still got a lot more to talk about. We want to jump into the dogs, etc. So we're going to close this session of RCP and thank our listeners very much for listening. Until next time on Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.